topic this week is global economics. So I will be doing 5 sessions on that particular issue. The topic for this one is the plea of the poor. We'll really be talking about the new international economic order. Before I begin, however, I would like to give you a little background about myself, because I think it would be helpful for those of you who haven't, or who are new to the village, to know a little bit about me, where I'm coming from, why I say some of the things I do, why I have the perspective I have. So to begin with, as I mentioned at the beginning of last week, I am white, male, middle class, a parent, a teacher, a U.S. citizen. Anybody who can make those claims knows they're on top. I mean, I have it made, and I realize that. Everything is in my favor, the way the systems tend to work. And for that reason, it has been very difficult for me in the last few years to try and look at what's being said by those who are oppressed or by those who are on the other side. I've grown up in a system that catered to people like myself, and so gradually I've tried to learn a little more about what it's like to be the male, female, the rich, the poor, the parent, the child. So first of all, that's where I'm coming from. I think I have some good intentions, and that I'm trying to learn more about what it's like to be on the other side in this world. My specialty is economics. I was trained in the area of economic development, especially the development of the third world countries. I'm very interested, however, in the human dimension, and I would like to think I'm more interested now in human development, and I'd like to see where economics fits into that. I think that one of the major concerns I have is that we live on an earth that is so rich in resources, and yet we have millions and millions of people who do not live decent lives in an economic, from an economic point of view. I think that is an embarrassment to many of us, or at least it should be, and as Christians we need to be concerned. And so the topics that I'll deal with this week are not what I would consider intellectual exercises for myself, but things that are of great concern to me. As I mentioned before, it's dangerous to leave the solution to problems up to experts, because experts tend to become so narrow and specialize so much. But one thing I want to make clear at the outset here is, as I deal with some of these issues, I will give you my perspective, but I invite feedback. When I got the chance to come here to Holden, I saw it as a great opportunity to get feedback from others, to learn from you. So I won't be presenting my viewpoint, but I, as I mentioned, very anxious to get any feedback that you're willing to give. I like to think of myself as a global citizen. Oh, I happen to be loyal to Decora and Luther College, even though Luther College isn't a place of higher education, I found out this morning. I'm loyal to the state of Iowa, to some extent, to the United States, but mainly I see myself as a global citizen. I'm a member of God's creation and God's family. When I look at problems, I tend to be interdisciplinary. That won't come out so much today, but it will later on during the week. I've had chances to teach on interdisciplinary teams, and I realize that it's very dangerous to try and solve any problem from just one discipline. And so I dabble in other disciplines, and I probably make some mistakes, but at least I like to bring it into the discussion. I have, as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm on the top, and I've worked very hard lately to try and listen to those who are oppressed, the downtrodden, the poor, and I hope that will come out during this week. And then, I guess the final point, I think whatever we need to do it with a great deal of humility. The more you learn about complex problems, the more you understand that you don't have every single answer. And for that reason, I hope I don't come across as a person who thinks that here are all the answers. I'm trying to give you some insight so we can all learn, move forward, and I hope that you can help me learn too. Before we begin the topic for this evening, I want to say something about terminology. Economists do an excellent job of losing everybody in a matter of minutes by throwing around fancy terms. And I'll try and keep them as basic as possible. And if there is something that I say that just you just don't catch or it doesn't make sense, interrupt me at any time and I'll try to further explain it. First of all, I'll be talking about the NIEO, because just to abbreviate, the New International Economic Order. I put that on the board over here. But I'll say that so often just to shorten it. It'll be the NIEO. Basically, we're dealing with the gap between the North and the South. The South generally is composed of South America or Latin America, Asia, and Africa. The North being North America, Europe, and we don't often talk about the socialist countries or the countries like the Soviet Union in this category. I may refer to the South as the Third World. And there are many ways we try to divide the world up. Third world, fourth world, fifth world. But I'm just going to keep it to first, second, and third world. First world meaning the North. Second world, the Soviet bloc, East Europe, basically. The third world, Latin America, Asia, and Africa. I probably should spend a little bit of time saying a little bit about the gap between the rich and the poor. Who are the poor? And I brought along the World Development Report for 1980, and I could run through it, and I could list some of the countries and give you per capita incomes to give you some idea. But I don't think I've got the time, and I'm not sure I want to spend much time on that. So I'll just simply say that the countries in the North, some of the richest countries have a per capita income. That means the income per person of around $10,000, $10,000. So a family of four would have an income of about $40,000. That means I'm not average. The people in the South have incomes much smaller. $200 per capita, $400 per capita. Some in Latin America, a little higher, $800 per capita. So there's a real disparity, a real wide gap between the rich and the poor. And I could give you many other characteristics. Too, and if anybody's interested, I'd be glad to let you look at the book later. Tonight you're going to get a crash course in international economics. And I'll try, what can I say? The topics we're dealing with tonight are not the kind of topics that you put in the paper and you see just floods of people coming to listen to you speak some evening. I mean, New International Economic Order. Those problems are far away. International. Economics. Economics is, as I'm sure you all know, the dismal science. I mean, it's been called that for years. First of all, because Thomas Malthus predicted that we would all live at a subsistence level. We didn't have any chance of rising above that. So it was called the dismal science. Then after we started teaching it in the universities, it became the dismal science for other reasons. But I guess I appreciate the fact that you're here. And so I'll at least give you a few sources, and if you'd be interested in looking at some of these, I would encourage you to do so. First of all, the book that I'll be using and referring to often during this week is by James McGinnis. It's called Bread and Justice. James McGinnis is a Roman Catholic and has his own Peace and Justice Institute. The subtitle is Toward a New International Economic Order. This book has been used, at least as far as I know, at three of the Lutheran colleges, and used very successfully. It's easy to read. The economics is not overpowering, and one of the best things about it is it talks about action. It doesn't just lay out the problem and then end. It talks about things that we can do. So I found the book to be one of the best around. It's a good reader, a lot of good examples, and as I said, I'll be referring to it throughout the week. There's another writer that I would highly recommend if someone wanted to really get into the economics of it. It's the fellow from Pakistan. His name is, I'm not sure how to pronounce his first name, Mubal, something like that, Al-Haq, H-A-Q. I don't think there's any doubt he's the leading spokesperson coming out of the Third World. He works with the World Bank, originally from Pakistan, and he has so much power, he is convening the world leaders from all the countries in Mexico later this fall to talk about some issues of the New International Economic Order. Now, there aren't many people from the Third World country who have that kind of power or respect that they could convene that kind of a meeting. He is very articulate. He seems to be very fair in his presentation. And so he's got a book out called The Poverty Curtain and a few others. There's a little pamphlet that he has here, about 40 pages on the New International Economic Order, which I also think is very good. Well, why are we going to study this topic tonight? There are a number of reports that have come out in the last year, all of them saying that if not the major issue, one of the major issues facing all of us in the future is the gap between the people who live in the North and the South. It is a serious problem. The Brandt Commission put out the North-South report. There's a Global 2000 report put out by the President's Commission. Number of reports coming out. This issue, no matter how far removed it may be to us, is very, very important to a lot of people in the world. When I worked in Latin America, I thought the best way I could really help would be to return to Latin America and do some more work. My friends down there said, if you really want to help us, go back to the United States and teach the people in the United States what's really going on in the world. They don't understand, and there's more work to be done there in just understanding, and to come back down here and do some things that we should really be doing ourselves. So, because of some past experiences, because of this concern, because many people, not just economists, politicians, whatever, are writing about the urgency of this problem, and basically because as a Christian, I think we have a God of justice. If you look at the life of Jesus and his relationship with the poor and the oppressed, I think it is our responsibility to listen, to hear what the oppressed are saying, what is coming out of the South, and then to try and study it and see how we think we should act based on what we've learned. So as a global citizen, one who respects shalom, that concept, I think it's very important that we try to listen. So what I'm going to do tonight is I'll try and engage you to some extent in discussion. This is probably not going to be very easy because when I teach an economics course at Luther College, and you assume a lot of them are there because they're supposed to be interested in economics, I'll often ask, how many have heard of the New International Economic Order? And I don't think I've ever had a class where there were more than 10% who had heard of it, let alone understood it very well. And yet many claim it's one of the issues facing the earth today. So I don't expect any of you to be, if there are some real authorities out there, great, that would be fine. But I don't expect, if you are, you're in the minority if you know much about it. And so I'm not expecting you to come up with any profound statements. But on the other hand, I really welcome discussion. There are a lot of misconceptions, things that you hear just aren't correct. And so I hope that you don't feel any pressure not to speak up or say something. Challenge me, say something, add something. If it's not clear, speak up. Because most people just are quite uninformed about what's going on in this area. Should I ask how many here have ever heard of the New International Economic Order? Yeah, I'm going to. How many have? No. Okay.
That's about right.
Okay. I'll just start with a few questions to try and get this started and see if I can get you involved. Do any of you have any idea what the real plea of the poor is? And when I say the plea of the poor, I'm referring to the third world or the South. That plea may hold also for the third world in the United States. Blacks, women, Native Americans, for example. But I want to leave it at the international level now. Anybody want to have any idea? What is the plea? What is it that they want? McNamara has gotten on board, not originally, but he is now supporting it, at least in rhetoric. The World Bank is having some problems carrying out any action in that area. But McNamara, yes, has been quite supportive, especially of the meetings in 1974 that he came out very much in favor of the International Economic Order. Yes.
Energy and how they need it to process the food. Fine.
Justice? Yeah, energy certainly fits in and is becoming very important. justice?
The ability and the chance to compete in a fair market.
Right. Okay, you've been reading, that's good. Okay, we've got a good start here. If I were to say, or just summarize what I thought it was, basically it is a plea for economic justice at the international level. You said it better than I'm going to be able to say it. They want opportunity to be able to compete fairly in the marketplace as it exists between nations. Does that mean they want any changes?
Yes.
Why? Do you have any idea? What's wrong? Here, let me do something. Before we get into that, I want to try and present an argument for you, or to maybe convince you that we don't need to make many changes. We in the North, probably some of you, I don't think I can include all of you in here, but most of the people in the North tend to ignore this call for a new international economic order. They see the market system, they know how capitalism has worked in the United States, the market system, and they say it seems to be working fairly good for most people. Sure, there are people who are having problems, but it's pretty just, it's pretty fair. And so what's going on at the international issue? They can't understand what it is. So here comes your crash course in international economics. I'm going to do a very simple example. We're going to have two countries and only two goods. I think it's because economists can't handle much more. But the simpler the example in theory, and the more it says, the better the theory. So we'll take two countries. We'll take the country of Peru, one in the south, and we'll take Norway. We're going to let them produce two goods. In Peru, we'll let them produce papaya, that's papaya juice, fruit, and we're going to let the other one be left. It's a lot easier to talk about something you care about and something you don't care about. If Peru used all the resources it had in its country to produce lepsa, I'm going to assume that it could produce 80 units of lepsa. If it turned around and used all of its resources to produce papaya, it could produce 80 units. Of course, no country will completely specialize, but that's not the point we're trying to make now. And they can produce any combination of the two goods. So they could produce, let's say, 40 units of lepsa, 40 units of papaya. Now in Norway, I'm going to assume that Norway can produce 180 units of lepsa if it used every resource it had to produce lepsa. And if it was going to produce papaya, it would produce 60 units. They could produce any combination of the two. In fact, we'll work with the combination of let Norway produce the papaya, because every time they do it, you lose three lepsa. Here you're only going to lose one. So economists say that you have a comparative cost advantage. Who can produce it the cheapest? And it's measured in what you give up. And a real cost is what you give up. It isn't the dollars and prices you put up. It's what you really give up. So we're going to let Peru produce papaya because they do it the cheapest. They only give up one less stuff. Now we're moving into a concept of specialization. We're going to let Peru specialize and produce papaya. Now what will we do in Norway? Let's see, what does it cost to produce one lepsa in this country? You've already got the equation there. One lepsa costs one papaya. Now to produce one lepsa in Norway, let's see, we gave up one papaya to produce three lepsa. So to just produce only one lepsa, we only have to give up a third of a papaya. So which country produces the lepsa cheapest? Norway. They only give up a third. Global citizen, they only give up a third. So, we'll let Norway produce the lepsa. Now, yes.
But isn't doesn't Lexus bring a higher price on the world market than the Caparezza?
No answer. No. Well,
I don't think there's any doubt that it should. No way of knowing the taste and preference.
Oh, so can we cheat it again? I mean, can we cheat it because they're going to earn less with their papaya stuff?
Okay. let's see what happens when we start trading, all right? We're going to take it as the unit, one papaya. Here's the papaya. Now, we said Peru's producing it. If they are going to gain, what are they going to want to get when they trade that papaya to Norway for lefse? At home, they gave up one lefse to get one papaya. If they want to do better, they're going to want what? More than one lefse or less? I hope more than one lefse. So they'll want anything more than one lefse. Anything greater than one lefse is better than they can do at home. Now let's go to Norway. Norway's got the lefse, and Norway gives up three lefse to get one papaya. Now, if they're going to gain, what do they want to do when they get that one papaya? Give up less than three lefse. There may be some Norwegians that are a little confused and would say four or five is okay. But most of them would say we should give up less than three lefse. So less than three lefse. Now, we've got a range in here. If the world price, that's the price at which you trade papaya and lefse, is anywhere between this gap. Here we have a continuum. One lefse here, three lefse. Anywhere between that gap says both countries can gain. Now that's a very important lesson to learn at the individual level, at the state level, at the national level, at the international level. If you specialize and then trade, you gain. And whenever somebody talks about, well, we're going to become self-sufficient and do it all ourselves, they're really giving up this opportunity to specialize, trade, and gain. I'll show you that more clearly in just a couple seconds. Let's say that, we'll just draw it right down the middle. You brought up a point. My guess is that those three lefse, my guess is that Norway wouldn't have to give up three lefse. They give about 1.0001 lefse because, you know, it's good stuff. But here's the two lefse. Now what happens? Peru gives up one papaya and they get two lefse back. You see what they just gained? At home they gave up a papaya, only got one lefse. Now they get two. They gained the lefse. All right, okay, yeah. Now, what did Norway do? They gave up three lefse to get one papaya. But on the world market, they only have to give up two lefse to get one papaya. Norway gained. Well, I'll go over here and show you these gains a little better. Is this going to be hard to see? Hang on, I'll put it here. Right. Here's Peru, let's say, before they specialized. Let's assume that they had, we were right in the middle, and they had 40 lefse and 40 papaya at home. Okay, are you with me? And Norway, when they start, they have 25 papaya and 105 lefse. Now there's no trade. They're doing everything alone. They're at home, doing it alone. Then they say, gee, we ought to specialize and trade, and maybe we'd all come out winners in this. We could all gain. So, by comparative advantage, you compare the cost, who produces it the cheapest, what are you best at doing, we let Peru produce the papaya, 80 units of papaya. We let Norway produce 180 units of lefse. Now, I hope you realize that no country would ever specialize 100%. It gets pretty expensive to get people producing lefse all over the United States. You get some of those who aren't very good at doing it, and the resources aren't so good. Now, we're going to trade, and I'm just assuming this, but this is fairly reasonable. At a rate of 2-1, we'll assume that Peru is willing to give up 35 papaya. They'll trade that now. They specialize, now they're going to trade. They give up 35, and they'll get 70 lefse in return. 2-1. And we're going to let Norway take in the 35 papaya and give up a minus sign, that means export, the 70 lefse to Norway. What is the end result after trade? Peru produced 80, they traded 35, you subtract it, and they've got 45 papaya.
What happened? 45 pie and there are only 40 over here. I just picked up 5. Now, they didn't have any lefse because they're not producing it, Norway is. But they pick up 70, so they have 70 after trade. And you compare that with 40. Gee, they've got 30 lefse that they didn't have. And you go to Norway and you find that they have no papaya. They trade for 35, they get 35. But they started with 25, they picked up 10. And you go to the lefse, they had 180, they trade 70, goes out of the country, they end up with 110, they had 105, they gained 5. You see these gains over here. Terribly important. And people who are so supportive of free trade in the world, specialization in trade, use these arguments to say that we should be very supportive of free trade. Free trade's wonderful. What's wrong with the existing world order? Look at what happened. We've got, when we started, we had 40 papaya and 25 papaya. Is that right? 40 and 25. That's 65. And now, when we specialized, we ended up with 80. We went from 65 to 80. With lefse, we had 40 and 105. 145, we end up with 180 when we specialize. There's the difference right there by specialization. Now you've got all of that extra, start trading, and both countries can gain. Now, is that convincing?
No.
One problem there.
Okay. That's what we've got to get into now.
Peru loses its skill in making lefse.
Oh. Okay. That's not a bad idea.
I mean, if one country is real large and one country is real small,
like
then. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that by specializing in trading, the only time you would do that is if those slopes were different, because then one can produce it cheaper than the other. If both slopes were 3, then there's no reason to trade. Anytime the slope's different, there's a basis for trade. You may not specialize 100% because of the size of the country. But as long as the slopes are different, there's a basis for trade, and there's always the potential for both countries to gain. So what's the third world saying? What's wrong? I mean, can you see why the people in the United States go, well, we traded when we were a young country, we specialized and traded, and we became very rich, and why shouldn't we continue to do this on an international level? Okay, there's one. Let me erase the board here. Put some of this down. Okay, do you use the word basic? Commodities. Okay. Just so that I don't get confused myself, I tend to refer to those in a lot of economists as primary goods. Okay, that's one. What's being produced? That's pretty important, and we'll go into that in a few minutes. You mentioned one of the problems with it was what? The demand is good or is not good? Okay. Demand, you're talking about that? Okay, you got your, yeah, okay. The demand is, we'll just use some terms like, it's not very good. If it's oil, no, we won't count that. But food, how much food can you eat? So you can produce more and more and more food. People can only buy so much. That the demand is not real good. There's not a lot of growth in those areas. Okay, some other ideas.
And they are also dependent on technology for the others, I mean on the north, and technology is really expensive, so they, you know, get more larger and larger deficits.
Okay, the whole issue of technology, where is it going? Who has it? Some other ideas.
It seems to me that before you can compare Peru and Norway, you have to consider what are the needs of the people in the country.
I think you're on my fourth lecture. You really made a jump there. We assume that if we use the free market, that market's dictating what people want, because it says what they're willing.
I'm not talking about what people want.
No,
what they need.
Yeah, the market says what are they willing and able to buy. And I'm going to talk market all night long. Your issue is very important, and it'll come up later. But now we're talking about the market and the way you record what What determines what's produced here is demand. And demand says, are you willing and able to buy it? I'm willing to probably buy a number of things, clearly not able to. On the other hand, there are many people able to buy things and not willing, they don't want it. But the whole issue of needs is not in here at this time. And I'm not even going to put it in at this stage. We're going to work with the system the way it is. That point, I think, will come up, though, just a little bit later. So I mean, I'll wait. I'm going to put that in here. Because that's a real good point, because I think about it a little bit more. Needs. Where does the needs fit in here? People who don't have incomes, very low incomes, how do their needs get met? Anybody else want to try some other things? Anything else that you might see wrong with this? Control of resources.
I mean, Mark, it may be a part of the same thing, but the existence of the resource, if anybody's got any, the distribution of the resource.
Okay.
In this graphic, are you assuming that through the natural resource, the resource that you have is best utilized in making the plan? In other words, do you sacrifice by that specialization?
In such a simple model, we only have two goods. I can make that assumption. When you go to something with many goods, many countries, then it becomes more complex and you have to compare their cost advantage with many other countries and other goods. But in this case, yes, I am. I'm assuming that it's the best they can do from a world perspective. Oh, by the way, I didn't summarize this model. I forgot to. This is the most efficient way to allocate resources. If you're really concerned about stewardship of resources, I might also add, if you're really concerned about economic growth and producing as much as you can, because that's important to meet unlimited wants, you cannot do better than this. Specialize as completely as possible, because I don't know if you noticed this, I never changed the inputs, the resources that the countries had. By using the same resources, we ended up with a lot more output. That is the most efficient way to produce. And anytime people start talking about self-sufficiency or becoming more self-reliant, they are talking about less output given the inputs. Now, I'm not, whether that's good or bad, I want to talk about the hole in the economy just a little bit tonight. Or maybe I should say the hole in the economy, the hole in the informal economy. Because I'm not so sure that's bad. But if you really want to produce as much as possible, notice that's the most efficient way to go about it. And many would say that it will lead to peace, it leads to higher levels of living. Because everybody's getting more. Okay, yeah.
What about war? How does Peru get less than when they're at war with Norway?
I'll put that in as an aside because we're going to have to assume free trade. The minute you bring in politics and who gets along with what country and all of that, you get restrictions to trade. And there are umpteen reasons given, and that's not what we're going to talk about tonight. So for now, let's not.
What about when Peru specializes in papaya and Colombia produces it twice as efficiently as Peru?
Well, then we'll have to get a third good in here somehow, I think, and let Colombia produce it. It's so hard. When you have two goods in two countries, you have to limit it to that.
How many people are employed in producing papaya versus
that? Okay, we're going to go to employment.
Mark, does this assume that by they were specializing like this, they still can feed their own people? That there's still enough resources left to feed their own people?
Okay.
At least it improves their ability to feed. Mark, you said that we're producing more.
Clearly the potential is there to have a better ability to feed the people. That potential is there. Whether it happens or not, is, I don't know why I always get in the habit of saying, if whether it happens or not, that's the subject of the next lecture. I just love it when you anticipate and you do advertisements for me. because that's an internal problem. I'm talking international right now, between countries. That becomes an internal problem. Tomorrow it's, why is the third world poor?
So ideally the system should allow people to feed themselves if it just works like it doesn't work.
The potential is there. Ideally, we would like to think it would happen.
I think one of the concerns today is it's a long way from Peru to Norway, and the cost of transportation is grant number two. Increasing expense. Sometimes it will cost more to get it there than if you currently gain from the
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think now we're getting into the to some of the real specifics. And I think what I'll do is just step back and look at what I see as some of the major problems and try and incorporate some of these ideas.
What happens with all the eggs in one basket and all of a sudden something happens that changes that picture for that country?
That's certainly an element of risk, and that's why a lot of people say that if you promote free trade, you're promoting world peace, because everybody depends on everybody else so much that they can't afford to go to war. You can always also say that if you think you can afford to quickly change over, you've got a big advantage if you go to war. But I mean that's what business will say. Let's build up that interdependence, and that's the way you promote world peace. And so hopefully nobody would feel they could do that. If they did, sure, we'd have enormous problems. Okay. Well, the first problem that I see with this, as far as the third world's concerned, is what I would call static gains. We've got some gains over here. Let's see, we ended up with 35 lefse and 15 papaya. That's what we gained by specializing so we could trade. The question is, how are those gains going to be distributed? The gains are there, but which countries are going to get them? I don't think you can assume any country will trade knowing it's going to lose. Except maybe Norway. I'm 100% Norwegian. You live in Decorah, Luther College, you can't help but think Norwegian. How will those gains be distributed? What's it going to depend on? It's going to depend on who has the economic power. And in these markets, who tends to have the economic power? The third rule tends to say that when we buy goods, we are price takers. And when we sell goods, we are price takers. In other words, we don't control the price. I'll give you, maybe what I need to do is go back to the point that you raised a little earlier.
You mean we, the third world.
Right. Okay, here's the third world. I'll put the South, just so I can abbreviate a little easier. The South produces primary goods. About 80% of their exports are primary goods. The North produces many more manufactured goods, much more capital intensive. You know why that happened? It's really historical development. That's one thing we don't understand very well in the United States, how countries develop historically. But the South are, they're all latecomers to this process. The technology, the machinery, all of that showed up in the North, and they produced it, they got a head start, and they had the advantage because they had the capital. So they're producing manufactured goods, the South primary goods. That's a generalization, but basically that holds. When it comes to primary goods, you know what the South tends to do? They compete with each other like crazy. Each country trying to produce more cocoa beans, more bananas, whatever, as they compete and compete. They just make the supply of their goods go up pretty fast, and they try to get new technologies. But when they sell their goods, they're not selling to very many nations or very many corporations. There's only a few places to sell the goods. So the people who demand the goods have a great amount of power. They can say, we don't want to buy. We want to buy. We only want to buy so much. And more or less set price as they compete with each other. They really get hurt when they try to sell products. And with these products, if you see their prices, they fluctuate a great deal. I mean, if you bought sugar, coffee, whatever over the years, you know how they were going up and down. They don't have much control at all over these prices. When it comes to manufactured goods, what happens? Who are they buying from? Big corporations, generally, manufactured goods, computers, high technology, and these are usually being sold by, well, I'll put in here multinational corporations, but by big companies. And they are one of the few selling, and many buying And by controlling the supply, they're able to operate more or less like not a monopoly, but oligopoly. And so the power tends to lie with those who produce manufactured goods. Those who produce primary goods don't have very much power. They don't have much control over those prices. Now, I think the best way to try and bring that home is if any of you farm and you're not a real big farmer, you don't have a large farm, you work your fool head off putting more fertilizer on or whatever and get the yield up, and everybody else is doing it, and you go to sell your crop, and where's the price? Everybody's trying to sell it, and you've got four or five big Cargill, whatever, trying to buy, and it's difficult to get much money for it. But when you go to buy your inputs, the fertilizer, the seeds, the tractors, whatever, who are you buying from? The major companies. And you don't go and say, well, that tractor's too high, I think I want to pay less. They're able to control those prices more because they can control the supply. I don't want for one second to give the impression that monopolies set any price they do, because I don't think that's true at all. But they control the market, and they can instead of flooding the market with tractors and pushing the price way down, they can control those kinds of things. So what happens in static terms is most of the gains, or more than a fair share of the gains, tend to go to the north because of economic power.
The existing international economic order, the present international economic order, is not a conspiracy. And I really do believe that. I've got good friends, good relatives, there are good people in the north. And I don't think all of you people are sitting out there day in and day out to try and figure out how to get most of the gains and the dynamic gains and keep the system going and going and going. I just don't believe it. It's not a conspiracy. But the system appears to be back in favor of the rich, the powerful, and the strong. And I'm going to pick up on that a little bit more tomorrow night in a little different term. I don't like to go around and point fingers and say, at myself or whatever, and say, oh, you're responsible for that system and all of that. But I think we need to recognize what's going on. And this gap between the rich and poor is growing constantly. We need to be aware of how that system is. Nayeri, who is president of Tanzania and one of the leading spokespersons for the South also, says that if we send our students to the North to learn, and you teach them, blocking beneath, you teach them the law of comparative advantage, and what you're really doing is you're trying to rationalize exploitation. He says that it's okay if the United States wants to have capitalism, fine, we're not going to say anything about that. We'll have our own system of Ujamaa, Africa socialism, fine. But when the nations interact between each other and there's a lot of inequality, what does that system end up doing? Nayeri would say that the South is doomed in this system. Now, that doesn't mean there are no gains at all. I want that to be that clear. But most of the gains, the static gains, is going to the North, and most of the dynamic gains go to the North, and that brings a much more rapid growth. Because of that, we're doomed in this system. The existing international economic system is sterile almost as far as we're concerned. He goes on to say, if the free market is going to work, trade must take place between equals. Or if not perfectly equal, but close to equal. How do you do that? That's a real tough problem. I'll make two suggestions here. I think it needs to be made very clear that this is not a plea for charity. Nobody's asking for handouts or charity. It's a plea for equity, for fairness. You're not saying, let's redistribute all of the wealth, whatever happened in the past, you know, let's redistribute it all as a concession for the past colonialization, let's say. It's simply a struggle for economic justice. Now, for me, that's not a very big request. They're saying, we work hard. We just want a chance in this system. And when we're small and all competing with each other against big buyers or sellers, it's awful tough for us to do that. Success doesn't seem very just. The heart of economic justice is this equality of economic opportunity. I don't know how you feel about that, but it doesn't sound very radical to me. It's just a real concern that the system is just,
it's not always impossible to achieve. It's the third world
it deals with us at all, they're going to always come out second best. I think it's kind of like a professional basketball player, somebody that's 90% is good as a player in the NBA. The player in the NBA makes 500,000, the person that's 90% is good makes nothing. So the third world country can make a 90% a good item and there's no demand for it. So there's a lot. They shouldn't deal with it at all from their experience.
I might just quickly list some things that they'd like to do. But before I answer that, what's going to happen if they take that way? Think of the repercussions. If they decide, hey, this system isn't for us. I think we'll keep our chromium, our oil, our whatever at home and use it for ourselves. So when people say that the NIEO is something that's just going to give all kinds of benefits to the third world, we have an awful lot of space here. In fact, I think what I need to do is I need to go quickly here and raise a few more points. Why should we listen? I'm going to give you five reasons. And I hate to say that none of these are based on Christian concern and responsibility. I think that's at the top. But I'll give you five other ones to think about. The first one is demographic trends. 70% live in the South today. They have 17% of what's produced. 70 gets 17. By 2000, it'll be 80%. By 2050, it'll be 90%. How long can a shrinking minority control a majority? Military power. As long as the minority had physical control over what was going on and dominated, it was fine. But we already had an example today, this morning, of what's going on with some of the Israel may not be, they're on the border of being third world countries, but Iraq, and building nuclear plants, and what all of that leads to. Economic power, OPEC, South Africa, all of South Africa, Zimbabwe could be, they've got some good raw material. Financial power, you know what the massive redistribution of wealth from the north to OPEC? No, there has never been a redistribution of wealth so massive and so fast in such in that sort of time before. That's financial power. And political power, more votes. And I think the very point you raised is really important. Because if we don't work something out, which will be to the benefit of all of us, right. It's not like we're saying we're not going to make any gains so much, this is maybe real fair. If we can't do that, what's the next step?
Then we don't even care about that.
History tends to support that, people do not give up power willingly. That's why the new approach in this has been to convince the North that they have a lot of space and that they're going to gain a great deal, and so that it isn't as though you lose, it's that you lose for your own well-being. There's an argument here we haven't even talked about yet, that comes up tomorrow. This issue is still a little bit more complicated than I made it sound. Let me just quickly go through a few things that they want to do, and then we'll have to quit in the other 5-10 minutes. They need to find a little more power to combat the power in the North. So they talk about trade unions or cartels like OPEC oil, but it's been very difficult to do that. To try and prevent the fluctuation of prices and keep the prices high, they talk about pulling goods off the market, putting it back on. And so usually when you hear the NIEO, people talk about buffer stocks, common funds, indexation, all those kinds of things, which I find really pretty boring. You really have to be into economics to get into some of those things. But what they would like to do is find a way to get a little more power, which means maybe in region, trade together, work together as a unit when they go to negotiate with big companies. So I'm going to give you an example of an abuse here. It seems like Nestle always gets picked on, but it may be because Nestle publishes everything. But during the mid-70s, Nestle was paying only about 55% of the world price for their coffee beans when they were buying it. How can anybody do that? And they weren't even paying the world price, which wasn't very high in the first place. In this whole area, they're talking about a new code of ethics for multinational corporations. Anybody heard anything about that? A new code of ethics? They're having enormous problems trying to get that one through. But there are always changes taking place in multinational corporations. Subtle changes to try and make things a little fairer, to make the bargaining power a little more fair. Tariffs. Did I say anything about tariffs if you import? This is one thing that the North has done that really needs to be changed. If a third world country is going to export to us, sell to us a rawhide, we put like a 1-2% tax on a tariff. If they're going to export to us leather, we put about a 10% tax on it. If they're going to export to us food, we put on it about a 20% tax. Those have all been brought down a little bit, but we protect our local producers, you know, who've gone through those stages of production, and they're asking that those be lowered. They're saying, give us a chance to trade. Now, there's one example where they could get some organic means, move into some manufacturing, get some of the dynamic benefits, and I just don't see how we can avoid that. But you know what the problem will be? We'll lose jobs here at home, temporarily. They'll find new jobs, but there'll be some suffering in the short run that people have to readjust.
Mark?
Yes?
I have a question. You said that there's some changes in the
multinational corporations. Yes. Well, they tried to put them out. None of them are really official.
And multinational corporations are accepting these customers?
Well, they're not accepting them in full, but they're feeling the pressure, and I think they're much more sensitive to what's going on, and I've heard that new contracts that are being signed by multinational corporations are far different than the ones years back, and I think it's having some impact on them. Not all, but...
Because they recognize that they cannot keep on doing what they're doing. I can't believe that their hearts are beating. I can't believe that they recognize that they're wrong.
Yeah, they see the future and know that if they don't start making some changes, the pressure will continue to mount and they're bound to lose far more. I can't really answer that firsthand. I don't know. It sounds like a logical interpretation. When the third world is asking for chances to ship the goods on their own ship, when you have a powerful buyer and they say, we'll buy if you put it on our ship, and if you buy our insurance, all of it, just to give us a chance to do some of those things. Give us a chance to do more processing at home so we can ship it to you and you won't put tariffs on. Those are some, I think, very realistic requests. Science and technology. I don't know if you know what some of the third world countries go through to get science and technology, but they pay enormous prices to use some of the science and technology we have. And they're asking for some changes there. That's a delicate issue, to say the least. As far as credit goes, the credit institutions at the international level are set up where, according to how big you are and what you put into it, that's what you can borrow. So six nations run most of the international financial organizations. They have about 50% control. And they make the decisions. They have the voting power in the area of aid. Or what they're saying is give us more voting power in those situations and let us borrow money based on the potential for growth and need, not just on what we put in. Because most times when you're poor, what do? When you start at that level, where's your collateral? How do you get in and get the loans and the credit? You're asking for some assistance there that seems to be a little more humane. And in the area of aid, the United States tends to think that we're pretty generous. And I suspect maybe we were at times. We gave 3% to Europe after the war, 3% of what we produced, GNP. Now the NIEO has asked for 7 cents of 1% to be given for aid. Three nations have done that, the Norway, Sweden, and the Netherlands. The United States of the 17 nations in the OECD is 16 of 17. And we're either at 0.2 or 0.19 cents of 1/100th of 1%. We're not even close. And we're the only country that hasn't acknowledged it. We haven't even accepted that as a target. At least everyone else has. Let me just say a little bit about where it's going. The NIEO has been going since about 1964 when UNCTAD started. But nobody heard about it. And in 1974, it came before the United Nations. It was on the agenda. What has happened since then, there's been some progress that's been very discouraging. And the last update I heard was that they were trying to determine how to negotiate and take care of some of these problems with lowering tariffs, giving more voting rights in some international organizations. And what I heard from a person, from Jim McGinnis, was that the United States single-handedly blocked the, they weren't even asking for anything, they were asking about how to go about making these decisions. And everybody agreed, except the United States, and we blocked that effort. Right now there's a real stalemate going on there, which may be kind of consistent with the Reagan administration, with a number of things, because we do not want any international organization having any control over over the nation. We do not want someone above us making decisions that will affect our businesses. Are real reluctant to set that precedent. So we've really put some clamps down in this area. And I said, it kind of scares me, because the requests they make are, and as you said, even if they get in there, they're not heavyweights. Someone said, what about the distribution of resources in the first place? They're not going to be able to produce a lot. They're just asking to have a little chance to do some more development, to do a little manufacturing, to trade the goods when they have a comparative advantage, to not have to pay or to get fair prices for their goods, to get a little more economic power. They just want equal opportunity. Oh my. It seems mild, and yet we have not listened very good. And what's the next step is going to be? I'm not really sure.